evening, everyone. So we're kind of picking up where we left off. We're on chapter 11. And so what we're going into now is we've been reading, of course, about mindfulness. This whole book is about mindfulness and various aspects of it. But the coming four chapters are dealing with a traditional teaching called four mindfulnesses. And I don't recollect if we broke this up before.
Well, it was a long time ago. It was two summers ago. We did a little bit on the four foundations of mindfulness.
Right. So if you read Buddhism in general, you'll discover that Trungpa Rinpoche actually comes from a tradition different from a number of standard Buddhist teachings. Four mindfulnesses, in the more traditional sense, I'll just get this out of the way because otherwise it's just going to be a question coming up. Mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of dharma. So that tends to lend itself to a lot more philosophical discussion. Rinpoche's presentation is based entirely on practice alone, on the experience of practice, and on the actually encountering what we actually encounter in our experience in a more direct way. I'll put it that way. It's not that the other tradition isn't related to practice, it's entirely so, but this is more, has a more direct flavor to it. So appreciation, chapter 11, is really dealing with the body, mindfulness of body. Did people read the chapter? Did they see that relationship? That it's appreciation really is about really being here. It's about somehow just fundamentally connecting with now. And all we're ever doing is connecting with now or forgetting we're connecting with now. Trying to head back to now. The idea of appreciation here is not really about how wonderful everything is and how wonderful our practice is and how it's going to deliver us from all of our sorrows, but just to basically enjoy on some level. I mean, just appreciate fundamentally the ride itself, which is what comes up and what we experience. I think one of the most important things he brings up here is we really sit for sit's sake. Mm-hmm. If you can sit for sit's sake. It's not really a tongue twister. But it really just means sitting. And sitting means really giving up all these notions that I'm going to get somewhere from sitting. That's really radical. Because, you know, we're always introduced to the notion, well, we're actually trying to, like, work on our neurosis and our suffering and alleviate that and get centered and be real. And we have all this stuff that we keep on assuming could happen if we only sit. And I'm as guilty as anyone else of promoting this myself, I must say. So for all you people who aren't my meditation students, you have no idea how fortunate you are. But anyway, that's it. So, you know, it's very kind of rough. I mean, one of the things we discover is basically that it's okay to be what it is, and it's okay to be just that. I think even the part of this notion of losing and regaining heart, you know, it's like, I mean, the only way we can go through this is just somehow empty ourselves out. So
where is it?
It said page 72. Let me see if I can find it.
question about the group meditation retreat.
Oh yeah, right. Top paragraph.
Top paragraph. Yes, right. And so, you know, we all come in with something. We're hoping we can even just dump our stuff and get rid of it and relax, and you know. But I think, you know, the whole thing is just being here with it and finding out where it leads. Which is basically nowhere. And, you know, that isn't a bad thing. You want to say something?
No, I understand what you're saying, but it's interesting because even in the idea of, okay, I'm going to relax into this and I'm not going to have an expectation and I'm going to sit with it and it's not goal-oriented, but somewhere inside, I think I am looking for a goal of being peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a goal.
It is. Yeah.
And I think that's, if I may say, that's the inspiration to sit in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have the opposite of that, nobody would be sitting there if they had an experience of confusion or feeling like they've lost it or they're crazy or any number of definitions of what's going on around here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I'd be kidding myself if I didn't think I had a goal.
But that's called, it's kind of a trick, though.
Yeah.
Because it kind of,
I think actually when we say the sit for sitting's sake, we're being introduced to a more kind of advanced level of mindfulness. Rather than just getting people to get to the cushion in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I love this quote last full paragraph. Maybe you think nothing will happen, but you still secretly think nothing is it. So you're still waiting for something or other.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of like, you might have a goal, but you're wanting to get rid of the goal, but getting rid of the goal is still a goal.
Typical
type of thinking that kind of, I think, ultimately want to just let that thinking go. And
so that should go.
So, yeah, I mean, you could say that's a paradox, but finally, I mean, and the reason why I think this is being introduced, first of all, it's just fundamentally good meditation practice when all kind of notions or ambitions are dropped, and we can actually open ourselves up to something that's completely beyond conception. And it's not because we're trying to get there. It's more like it just falls on us. You know, it's like just suddenly discovering yourself really being there. And that is actually, you could say, the basis for an extraordinary sense of recognition. Now, we'll talk about this further down, down the road, because it's actually critical about some fundamental ordinariness to our experience that actually is the crux of the matter. It's what we do without ever trying to get anywhere or without having any intention. I mean, even in the midst of having an intention, there's something else that's just so ordinary, so fundamentally present.
Mm-hmm. You have a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jim.
Okay, so following on what you just said, so I get the don't have a goal idea,
mm-hmm.
But I don't understand the nothing happens idea, because what you just said is something that happens.
It actually doesn't happen.
I mean, it's
yeah, it's a koan. Like.
You could say you suddenly come to a point. A simple recognition dawns on you that you're just. It's just there. It's just the there-ness, and it's not object-subject oriented. You know, it's just simplicity.
Yeah.
Really, really simplicity. And admittedly, these can be very fleeting experiences, but they can leave a kind of a small mark on your practice. In other words, it's something that you could begin to recognize. Oh, you know, there's a sense of fun. I mean, when we talk about goodness or something that's fundamentally, it's like being in sync when you're really there. That's all. And you know, we do this. We don't only have to be meditating to do this. It's not like a formal requirement or anything.
Yeah.
because, you know, well, we actually can recognize that and appreciate it. And that's a very strong, I think that from that point of view, it's like the sense of this notion of appreciation becomes a foundation for realizing how simple it all is.
Did you want to say more?
Well, yeah, that's a result of solid practice. In other words, the only way you can get that is through having a consistent, solid practice. And then it just happens in flashes, and the flashes make it longer and more, less space between, etc. I get the whole goal thing, because once you look for that, it doesn't happen.
Maybe, but you know, sometimes I want to tell you, I've learned for months without anything like that, and I've been practicing. You know, you can practice for a long time, and you know, all you do is just experiencing the swirling mind business. So it's not like you're guaranteed of, you know, some kind of a front row experience of.
But you're guaranteed not to have it if you don't do it.
Well, maybe you can't make those kind of statements, because you might recognize it. You know, it's like we don't want to say this is the absolute and only way to go.
Right. Yeah. I have a coworker who had a rather dramatic illumination experience during a staff meeting at Apple. And it affected his life for a long period of time. He wrote a book about it, and he's continuing to feel the reverberations. But he had a couple of experiences in his childhood, but he had no meditation practice to speak mm-hmm. of at that time. Mm-hmm. But the experience did stay with him.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say at some point that there are many people who have a deep appreciation for the preciousness of life, who have never been Buddhists or anything. You know, it's not just Buddhists.
No, we're not talking about Buddhism being a prerequisite for appreciating life. Oftentimes when people die around you, you know, that's when anyone automatically sort of catapults into a much more sense of preciousness or a state of openness. The difficulty is within a week or two, we're back to just the usual grind.
But many people have an appreciation for just being, I think.
Enlightenment isn't owned by any ism.
No.
Yeah.
This is a path.
I have, you know.
So that has to be really known.
A bunch of nieces and nephews, and they always were told what was terrible about themselves. So I used to say, well, what do you like the best about yourself? And the 7-year-old said, I like it best that I'm alive.
That's
still gets up to see the sunrise. And it's just very.
So, I mean, in that sense, you know, we talk about this word peace or tranquility, which is the basis of shamatha practice. That comes from the word kshanti in Sanskrit, which basically is, it's just the sense, as Rinpoche emphasizes, the notion of groundedness. And this is just this basic simplicity. You know, it's like it's not an end in itself, it's just something that is really helpful to appreciate what happens. I thought the other thing is, so getting out of that stage or that, you know, that question for the moment, another interesting thing that's said here, a great teacher of meditation once said, meditation is trying to look at your eyes without using a mirror. And I actually had that instruction from Thukpa Ujin, who was a really remarkable teacher. He came to Boulder in the 70s, early 80s, and basically he was trying to be, everybody did everything they could to keep him away from the Sangha, because, you know, he just told everything, and he just told you anything, and just bingo, everybody just got it. That's how he taught. He just gave everyone kind of ultimate instructions. But he gave a simple statement. He said, sit up straight in your meditation posture and just look out, and then let your eyes turn around and look back in from looking out. And I thought that was a fantastic teaching at the time. I still do. It's a really interesting way it's one way of sort of bringing an abrupt cancellation to your spinning mind process. And, you know, so, I mean, that's what we really are, in some sense, disengaging, as we know. We're learning about spaciousness, we're learning about simplicity, we're learning about exploring the space between the thoughts, finding out there is space between the thoughts.
So how does this relate to body?
So this is fundamentally how the body is an anchor to fundamentally being here. You know, I mean, we can't do anything we want with our body. We have very specific limits. But at the same time, it provides us with a simple core of stability that is basic to the whole process.
Is this like it's a form and emptiness? What? It's a form, and then we, you know.
Oh, okay.
And then there's emptiness. There's the getting to that notion of lack of duality. I don't know. I'm wandering here. Sorry. That, you know, this is a form that, as you said, grounds us. But within that form, there's always emptiness in conjunction with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, empty really means open.
Yeah.
And, you know, without a sense of solidity to it. But in this case, the body is an anchor. on another level, and I know this is probably off the wall, but I'll bring it up. Emily and Michael and I and some other people have been studying Bardo teachings about what happens when you die, the teachings about, and one of the issues about that is when you don't have a body, your mind is all over the place. You think a thought and you're there, you know, and your mind gets, you discover the mind is so fickle that finally it drives you crazy and you start looking for another body because there's no stability. This is one of the things, of course, that Tibetans talk about in terms of learning how to practice now so that we do develop a stability of mind. And we don't have to be subject to this crazy fickleness that just wants to go here and there, every, you know, every which way, and just pop, you know, any impulse that comes into our head, we're there. We actually, there's some kind of a settling process, and a settling into something that we will go towards called sanity, primordial sanity. You've heard this term before. Sanity. This has been something we talk about.
So I think this paragraph on nowness is really great because also it addresses what you mentioned about emptiness. So he's saying nowness is a good word to describe the experience of simply being present. There is no other reference point involved. You might think that nowness is a choice. This is on page 73 at the top. There is no other reference point involved. You might think that nowness is a choice between now and then, or between this and that, but the state of nowness is choiceless. Now includes emptiness and non-existence, as well as fullness, all at the same time. Now is powerful because it doesn't have any connections with past or future. We might feel threatened by now because we prefer to stick with what has occurred or with what might occur. We have difficulty ungluing ourselves from past and future. It's not particularly pleasant to be now. It is demanding, but it is also very genuine.
So that's definitely a good chunk to chew on, I think. Choicelessness. There's some choicelessness. Notion of choicelessness about now. You know, it doesn't require anybody to say yes or no. It's just what it is. And this kind of word, nowness, which, you know, basically is about what we're talking here, is also very simple, straightforward. It's straightforward. It's not like out there. Yeah, it's really very, it's just immediacy, the nature of immediacy. And it's where the anchor will be. I mean, so our body then can bring us back to simplicity, and we're just sitting where we are, we're doing whatever we're doing. When mindfulness goes into action, as it were, mindful act. Then you're just there with your body doing this, doing what you're doing, straightforwardly. And there's more capacity for accuracy at that point and precision. Precision at that point is not just about the mind, you know, sort of being highly, highly focused, but just fully engaged with the situation itself.
So within the body, like coming back to your breath, you're engaging back in your body to ground yourself, to focus, to be present now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is also discussed in the present moment chapter when he talks about not borrowing ideas from the past or fundraising for the future. And again and again, he's brought back to this present moment without elaboration.
I think the paragraph after the interview seems like for Mary, which is in the practice of meditation, the development of peace is the expression of now the peace of the experience of simplicity.
Louder.
In the practice of meditation, the development of peace is the expression of now. Peace is the experience of simplicity rather than pleasure or happiness as such. But it's all about, it goes out as a peace. It's like a rock simply sitting on the ground. So it just seems to be Mary, what you were talking about.
And so then the next thing he brings up is something that is very important, is understanding body as not something separate from mind, but psychosomatic. So in that sense, it is a part of the mind, and it's not separate from the mind.
Where are you now?
I'm now on that bottom paragraph in discussing meditation. We sometimes talk of page 73, the psychosomatic body, which is made up of both the somatic part, the body, and the psychological or mental part, the mind. Soma means body in Greek.
What about energy
pass
in your body?
Hmm?
Energy
pass
in your body.
Energy pass.
Mm-hmm.
What about energy paths?
Energy paths, yes. Well,
what does that mean?
You're not referring to that anyway?
Energy paths have to do with the circulation of energy throughout the body at any given time. And
that's part of the body?
It's definitely part of the body. We call that generally subtle body. And because of the gradation between... It's all called prana or winds, and so there's coarser and there's subtler winds, and then there's the central channel, which is where we really want to bring our energy in terms of simplicity. What that refers to is simply centering, being centered, bring everything into core essence, let everything settle into a core essence, and as a result of which then you can have some control over the flow of these energies as opposed to just being pushed around by them. I mean, they are what actually are part of our process of getting distracted, going off into thought, discursive thinking, you know, just chasing after this or that. And so while we don't have a direct means to understand this, at least I don't, some people use breath control, but that isn't an absolute certainty that, you know, working or controlling your breath will necessarily alone bring about a cessation of the thinking process or the process of distraction, let's say. I don't want to say that every thought is a distraction. There are certainly essential thoughts. But yes, that's the subtle body.
Do you think dreams
are
like that, not having an anchor?
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the body is cut off from sensation while we're sleeping, basically, from hearing.
Although we perceive, we feel, though, I don't know about you, but I often perceive I'm feeling something in my body and I'm saying,
yeah. It's so the brain is constructing, you know, what's not being
that's right.
Really sense. And it's looking for something to really build. And so our dreams are all over the place.
So that's mental body. That's mental body. It's a body of the mind, but that is at least, we know, detached from the actual engagement in the body during sleep. Right.
What I've come to realize from reading this book, Mindfulness in Action, is the importance of being fundamentally grounded in the body and the breath as a way to rein in the mind. That actually being in the body really helps us stay present. And I often forget that when I meditate, but I think just taking the posture of meditation is in itself a reminder to come back to the body. So there's something about the actual upright posture, and that's really stressed also, that there's a sense of uprightness, that connection seems to tether the mind in some way.
Right, and it also takes care of, it addresses the subtler energies of the flow. So posture, that's why posture is emphasized so much. And you'll notice people who have good posture tend to be more present. At least they convey that quality of presence. They're not caught up with all of their stuff. You know, I mean, so the idea of having good posture is important, and particularly in the context of meditation. That goes into the next thing, which is fundamentally now, and this can be confusing for people sometimes, the question of how we label. you know, this is we're looking at page 74, the second full paragraph, talking about your body sits, your body sensations come and go, you don't do anything with them. And so as questions arise about our experiences in meditation, this approach is to see these questions as thought patterns or thinking. In the practice of meditation, you label everything that happens in your state of mind as discursive thought. You say, this is thought, this is thought, this is thought, this is thought. Everything is labeled as thinking. So that means, and usually I discover how many peculiar sensations I have when I'm meditating. You know, it's crazy. It just won't stop out of nowhere. You know, I can be sitting here scratching myself all the time. And, you know, actually learning how to just be there with that, without feeling like I have to do something. You actually are actually learning how to really be present. And you know, this is labeling it is... it's just a way of not turning it into something big, I think. And certainly, when we have these sensations, it's not limited to just physical sensations. We get emotional states that often, because they're emotions, often seem so much, lift so much larger, you know, than what we would normally discuss, call some just a random experience going through our heads, that we actually have to learn how to, which we're learning how to equalize all of that, because we're really trying to like understand what shamatha is taming the mind. Taming the mind means basically leashing it, bringing it in, and it's an actual state of kindness. So our body is a way to really help, as we're seeing, because it gives us a sense of groundedness, of simplicity. No one's going anywhere right now. We're just here. I'm just here working with my breath here and now. So that's all there is. And it's actually fine, you know, even if it's extremely plain. Sometimes it can even be shocking to just notice that, you know, wow, you know, I'm just here, right? What? Okay. So,
I'm sort of curious now. There seems like a link between what we're talking about, I'm not sure how to frame it, and the consciousnesses we talked about when we talked about the sadhana, because the five consciousnesses, right, hearing, sense, taste, and touch, mm-hmm. are all how we experience body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, beyond that, I'm not sure what the connection is. I wonder how to think about. how we work, I guess maybe the question is how we work with those consciousness methods as the way of staying grounded.
I think we're basically in the fifth skandha the whole time here, unless we start to go deeper. That's where the eight consciousnesses and so on are happening. That is the word mind here has to do with the fifth skandha.
Okay.
Yeah, the other factors in our, you know, we can break this up in terms of components. They're components, but by themselves they don't make the whole thing work.
Yes.
The consciousness is what basically is kind of a unifying, a glue, as it were, putting it all together. That's how we experience things. We don't experience things chopped up into little fragments.
Right.
I mean, we can have momentary flashes of this and that, but actually that sense of flow is just gone, the sense of just the fundamental togetherness. And the five senses themselves are coordinated in the sixth sense, which is basically what's actually all holding it, as it were, seeing it as a unity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, you know, it's not just sort of like there's a sensation in my toe and that's all. I mean, it's like it's in a context.
Yeah.
Larger context.
I forget what the fifth skandha is. Is that consciousness?
Yes. The fifth consciousness, the fifth skandha is consciousness, yeah, right. So, okay, are there any questions from this chapter that we haven't addressed or would like to explore together?
I like the easy come, easy go.
Yes. What?
Easy
like come, easy go?
So regard whatever arises in meditation and thinking, let the thoughts pass through. Easy come, easy go.
Yeah, and that's going to actually apply very much in the coming chapter, the next chapter, actually, the whole notion of just going from one moment to the next and how that works.
And the last thing in this chapter, appreciating your experience in this simple way is the development of peace, which is the starting point in the practice of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious about, let me see if I can come up with a near page number, 74, I think. The paragraph begins, so many experiences arise when we practice. 75.
Yeah.
They are all relevant.
Yep.
You can't just say that such experiences are neurotic.
Mm-hmm.
As surprised by the word choice, because in the sense that, oh, that's just thinking.
Yeah.
Has a quality of, it might not have any meaning, any relevance. And so here, you seem to be saying, no, actually, it might, some things are relevant, or maybe everything is relevant.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It seems to be,
yeah.
I don't know how to put those two things together.
There's
actually, I just was thinking the phrase, it's just thinking, as opposed
right.
to it's thinking.
Yeah.
You know, that when you say it's just thinking, then that puts a, you've got attached a moral value to it.
You're dismissing.
Yeah. No, it's the opposite, I think. You're saying something you're about to make a big deal about. That was wrong. I'm not going to tolerate that. It's a thought. Okay? It's just thinking.
Okay. All right. Makes sense.
It is an equalizing. It's just an equalizing. Everything is equal. Nothing has high or low value here. Everything is fundamentally just as it is. But, I mean, the way you were phrasing that was more dismissive of just that. Just thinking without actually acknowledging. Thinking is just thinking. It's not like a hot. That doesn't mean it's something wrong. Or in any way that there's some problem necessarily. As he's saying, it doesn't have to mean it's neurotic any more than it's sane. But such experiences are just experiences. Our experience is real, true, and direct. I think that's really what that's the important statement here. And appreciating that just for what it is.
We're always cranking it up.
Yeah.
That's what's so interesting about all this. Like, we're always looking for entertainment.
And there's always, you know, the next thing. And it's so vanilla somehow.
I find it, you know, trying to deal with the judgment mind, trying to put a spin on it, if this is positive, this
right.
is negative,
yeah.
and putting it in a category as opposed to, you know,
Letting it be. So our real habit, which we continue discovering on more and more profound levels, is this thing reifying. We always, like, a new thing, a thing. I'm making a thing out of this, you know. When my parents used to argue in public, they'd say, oh, you're making a scene, you know, like, well, that was a big thing in those days, because when you're just, all the kids are all embarrassed, you know. Kind of look like they don't belong to their parents or something, you know, walk the other out of the room. But, you know, a thing, it's a singiness. It's always a thing. So when we sing, when we singify something, we're reifying, we're thickening it, we're turning it into something solid, which is actually not solid. And so that simplicity is not solid. It's fluid. It's open. And, you know, this is a deep habit that we will discover we can work on. We can release. And basically, by working on it, we don't take out our toolbox and start hammering away. We just let it rest in its own recognition. This is where the thinking, the labeling process trains us in actually just seeing without judgment. We're not making any kind of judgment on this story. Oh, I got to fix this. Oh, this is good. Let's save that. You know, none of that.
It's actually very compassionate. Mm-hmm. It's a mark of being compassionate. Moments to stop your me project.
I sort of accepting, you know, whatever happens when you're sitting there helps me other times. When, like I said, very rusty days, and I was talking, I'd be like, and I never said anything to anyone if they were around, but I was like, oh, yeah, that's, I am kind of just pissed off at this point. But I used to be very like, well, you know, whatever happens, it's fine. It wasn't really fine. But that piece of you saying that, yeah, you can have that, you can have the other thing, you can have a good day, a bad day.
All of it.
All of it.
And you get mad, if you get mad, that's part of the trip, you know, but I mean, at the same time, somehow, this just helps everything sort of relax.
Right.
And it doesn't turn into something else.
Right. You're not adding on. The add-on.
Right.
Well, you're not feeling obligated to say that's the good thing
I thought,
that's the bad thing I thought,
right.
Whether I'm sitting on the cushion or walking around.
That's exactly, yeah.
What
we
I
are,
thought.
That's, you hit it. That we are under no obligation. And that is a key point. What we're discovering in our practice is freedom. We're discovering freedom is such an essential aspect of all this. We are not under any obligation to lay judgment on anything. We don't have to get our hands into this. You know, I mean, we just let it rest in itself. We'll come back to that. Life force. So, okay, this is the actually another aspect of mindfulness. And the way that this is described is fundamentally, it's also called livelihood, mindfulness of livelihood. That's another way Trungpa Rinpoche describes it in different times. It's about being totally in touch and basically relaxing with that, realizing that our sensations provoke awareness. So, okay, how does this have so much significance in this context? One of the things he brings up is that life is a basis for anxiety. I mean, you know, that's basically where this is coming from. If we think about why are we suffering from anxiety, and I think having a short, you know, even a kind of like a cursory brush with meditation helps us tune into recognizing we encounter anxiety a lot in ourselves, right? So what are we anxious about? What are we having these issues of discomfort about? Actually, you know, like, you know, death, cessation, the end of all suffering, you know, is death. Oh, shit, you know, like, what was it? Life's addiction, then you die, right? You
know? is this anxiety issue pointed out in here?
Let's see, did I take this from here or did I sort of, I went, you know, I also looked at a few other
I know that,
conversations about this.
But you're making a very important point, and I'm not sure it's in here, but it's worth saying.
Well, no, yeah, he does, you know, for instance, the experience of pain may remind you about the possibility of death. We know we usually get sick before we die. I mean, he's talking about earlier the survival mechanism being triggered by sickness or illness or anyway setback, you know, physical setbacks or somehow finding ourselves in discomfort, continuously finding throughout the day some point or other where we get uncomfortable, we make adjustments, we deal with it. But I mean, you know, this is such a operative element in our psyche. Of just constantly on the lookout for, you know, possibly what could go wrong, what won't work, and then what, you know. I mean, I'm speaking for myself at least. Maybe some of us are free from that particular affliction, but
well, I don't think
I
so.
But
I don't. I know you're saying something very important. I don't see it right in the text here, but it is that we go through life continually in a state of anxiety because we have to keep dealing with life, breath after breath, hassle after hassle, and so on. So life can be a low-grade anxiety, and this, from the practice point of view, this chapter is about converting persistent anxiety into a sense of well-being.
Right. And
how do you do that?
So this is the magic, as it were, of mindfulness. I mean, it's the magic of simply the recognition that starts to occur. We're talking about the power of awareness. The mindfulness, you know, this recognition, when we actually see, as Michael just mentioned, the notion of life, of our life being in anticipation of more problems in this life. Obviously, if we're dead, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there are theories about what happens, but those are not really ultimately facts that we can know about. Those are more speculative. This is actually to do with just anticipating all the things that we don't want to happen. And so he mentions this notion of survival and the struggle, which we know in all sorts of different ways, as actually a stepping stone of meditation itself, that we can actually then use this energy as part of our practice. We bring it onto the path. That's how the term is bringing your experience onto the path. I'm having an anxiety attack. You know, like crawling the walls, you know. Bingo. Suddenly I can actually use that as a factor or bring it into my meditation practice. I can actually allow that to become a point of where meditation can actually occur, that actual moment. And in that moment, the whole thing starts to shift.
It makes me think, this experience where we live, we have electric heat. So we have to turn, every room is on a separate heater. And I realize, like, how painful it is. You're going from a cold room to a medium warm room to a this room and a that room. And I realize the whole thing is all about survival and how uncomfortable it is to be you know, okay, we turn the heat off in the bedroom, but then I have to get dressed in the bedroom. So I just pretend I'm camping.
I do that too. When you pretend you're camping, you can handle it.
I know. So I'm looking at this. This chapter is perfect because it's all of, you know, it feels like I'm just faced with this constant survival. And then the hot water heater goes off for like 5 days. I go to Erica's for a shower. The whole thing is just over and over this sense of struggle, like keeping, just keeping going somehow. It's so vivid with the heat.
Well, I last week where I live, no electricity for 25 hours. And now I know people have had it for weeks sometimes. But I mean, I just realized how everything, so much everything in this whole world that I live in, my entire day is built on being plugged into electrical systems. And you know, at first I just was going through this process of, you know, feeling really uncomfortable, when's this going to end? And then at a certain point I go, oh, well, you know, actually this is kind of interesting, you know. Why don't I just explore it for a while and see what happens, you know? So, I mean, you think about what we are so conditioned at this point to having all sorts of comforts and resolutions to things that took people all day 200 years ago to function with. I mean,
you turn the tap on and with water.
Yeah.
My family has a cabin. You have to hike a half mile to get into it. No electricity, no running water, you haul your own water. You go up there a week and you're just so thankful for food that's warm. You don't even care what the food tastes like. It's warm. And when you go to bed at night and it's so cold that your raw eggs freeze solid inside the cabin. And then you get so, your tolerance for just comfort completely changes by the end of the week. And then you come home and it kind of, you hang on to it for a little bit, and then a few days later you're upset because the shower went cold. You know, it's amazing to me how we acclimate, but then in both directions. We acclimate to higher tolerance, and then we acclimate to back to whatever the tolerance, the expected tolerance level is of where we are.
Well, I think this is where he talks about relaxing into mindfulness and being fully with the situation, whatever it is, because there's always going to be some fluke, wrench in the works. You know, if we're really there, we're working with it. And I mean, the one thing that, if there's any kind of like, say, a marker that a person who practices meditation could demonstrate, if they're really doing the practice at all, is a certain kind of flexibility that starts to occur. Yeah.
I know that one of the things that, you know, being in high menopause right now is actually a very useful thing during sitting, because in the abstract you can say that sensations and things are just weather that occurs, but there's such randomness and hot flashes. Mm-hmm. You become aware that there are these things passing through me, but that they have not, you know, I didn't cause it, didn't do anything wrong, it will pass or it won't pass, and then it actually turns out to be a useful experience during
and we'd like to share with all of
you. This thought occurs to 50% of the human race. I speak about it.
But imagine the, you know, there's the, like, body stuff or living, you know, like the outside stuff. But I think when we're talking about anxiety and the amount of people who are in their minds, like, no matter where they go, there they are, right? I think most of the human race, I think it takes so much, it's such a wonderful thing to have the opportunity to be able to discern and to be able to step away from and have that perspective. But having watched, you know, I deal with teenagers, and anxiety is a big thing. Mm-hmm. It's like epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, you know, just witnessing it in such a huge way, And we can buy into that story. I mean, I know I do. It's like it's easy when you go into your own mental dilemmas, whatever it may be, and that it's that's the stuff. That's like where the rubber hits the road in my mind. It's like when you're dealing with your own mishigas, your own mind.
I can remember reading this and the theme of turning anxiety into appreciation, which is the theme of this chapter, and it grabbed me deeply that over 20 years ago, and then my dog got sick to the point where he couldn't move anymore really, and I took the dog to the vet and the decision was made to put him down. So I was in the room and he's wired up to this injection stuff, and the dog is barely recognizing I'm there anymore, and but his body is very warm still. I put my hands on him, and then it starts to work, and out comes his very last breath with a deep, deep, deep sigh, and I realized the meaning of this, that all through life we have to take breaths one after another, and he finally went beyond that.
So while we're here, I think understanding this life force is really the key point. That life force is actually basically aliveness. Aliveness itself is really fundamental. Rather fundamental. I don't know how to follow that, Michael. Sorry, I did a second of this chapter.
I'll bring you back to what you're saying. But it's true. It runs through life from beginning. Page 81.
Yeah. Page 81. Quiet down, man.
Feeling your life force is an experience of being. It brings your mind into focus, into one-pointedness. You may wonder if it's really this simple, or you may feel that you've learned a new trick. In fact, it's the first trick and the last trick at the same time. It runs throughout the practice of meditation from top to bottom, beginning to end. So does that bring us back?
That's very good. And then he follows up, because we're running out of time here, just briefly. When you meditate, you are actually meditating even when you think you're not. You have no choice, in fact. In your mind, you may be miles away from your meditation cushion, but you're still sitting there. There is still communication between your body and your mind. It might seem like a schizophrenic level of communication to be aware of both the irritations of your body and your distant thoughts. However, you are having a real experience of life, a real experience of reality, whether you like it or not. There is some magic, if you'd like to put it that way, some force of life that takes place. It doesn't matter whether you have an enormous pornographic show going on in your mind or whether you're having a delicious mental meal miles from the meditation hall. In fact, you are still sitting in your meditation cushion or your chair. So, that's the key.
Being there.
I'm sure we could go further. It's now 9 o'clock, one more burning question, please. Anybody? Okay.
Yeah. Is awareness the life force? Is awareness the life force?
That's an interesting question.
Wow.
I think that we could say right now, yes. You know, just leaving it at that. It's really very simple. We don't really separate awareness from our experience. You know, and that's really important. Experience is life. So, and as we learn more and more about what we're experiencing, we're learning more about the awareness itself. So you begin to see like they're not separate, but they're not necessarily understood at the same time, obviously, right? Okay.
Question.